This is the Utah Politics Podcast from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm your host, political correspondent Brian Schott. Today is Friday, October 2nd, 2020. On today's podcast, coronavirus makes a house call to the White House, a story of two debates, should Utah still be in an emergency because of the coronavirus, Trump and LDS voters, plus I speak with Tim Miller from Republican Voters Against Trump. You'll hear that conversation as well. A little bit of housekeeping before we get to our guest today. I'd like to ask you to do us a favor, leave us a rating and review at iTunes or Apple Podcasts. I know you're probably tired of hearing this if you're a longtime listener of the show, but that helps us find new listeners. That's the way the Apple algorithm works. So if you leave that rating and review, then the show gets suggested to more listeners and so on and so on and so forth. So if you do that, would appreciate that. Also, share it with your friends and family on social media. All right, so that is out of the way. I'd like to welcome in my guest for today's political news roundup. It is Salt Lake County Councilperson Amy Winder Newton. She was also a candidate for the Republican nomination for governor this year. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on this Friday morning.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be with you, Brian.
Well, you know, it's really, really interesting because last night I got up and my phone was exploding with the news that President Trump and the First Lady Melania Trump had tested positive for the coronavirus. So I think that's probably the first thing that we're going to talk about today, because I'd like to get your thoughts on this and what you think it does to the race going forward.
Well, I think it's always tough when you have an election so close and you have a candidate that gets coronavirus. We saw that in Utah in the governor's race with former Governor Huntsman, and it definitely puts a wrench in your election and campaigning plans. So, you know, that's going to be a bummer for their campaign. I think it never hurts to humble President Trump a little bit and get a chance to show some empathy towards those who have had to experience the coronavirus.
So what do you think this does to the race itself, though? You know, there's a lot of people, stay off Twitter today. As Rick Wilson tweets, today is the day that spawned a billion hot takes on Twitter. So it's probably not a good place to go there. I made the mistake of logging on, and I've seen people talking about the president is faking this, which I think is a really stupid take. My thought on it, at least from a political standpoint, it is a distraction. But it's probably not the distraction that the president wants, because it brings the focus back to the coronavirus and what many people see as failings of his administration to handle this since it started back in March. You know, I think this is probably not the kind of distraction that he would want to have. Do you have any?
Well, and he's always positioned himself to look like he's a strong person and a strong personality, and his base has kind of loved that, right? I mean, they want somebody who's going to be a fighter, and I think that's even what he was going for in the debate a little bit. So to have him in a weakened condition like this, I don't think it hurts him among his base, but it will be interesting to see, you know, how they adapt to their campaign changes because of it.
The interesting parts, as I've been trying to suss this out all morning, is that the White House didn't say anything. This leaked, and then it was reported. Apparently, the president was showing signs on Thursday at his golf course, but he and his entire team, they didn't wear masks. I worry about what this might do to Joe Biden, because we've got two candidates who are 74 and 77, and the coronavirus is not a good thing for people in that age cohort to have. So, you know, the president, the former vice president, was also exposed. We're hearing that RNC chairman Rona Romney McDaniel tested positive on September 25th and didn't tell anybody. The president attended a bunch of fundraisers. You know, it just seems unconscionable that you don't tell people that you've tested positive. But maybe it gets back to trying to control the message, because you don't want this getting out. And the only reason it got out is because it leaked. So, you know, I think that might be something that dings them. One good piece of news, though, is that the vice president has tested negative. So it means next week's vice presidential debate here in Salt Lake City is still on.
Yeah, because that would have been a bummer. I mean, I know we're all looking forward to his visit, and it's great.
I have to go get tested here. I have to go get tested tomorrow so I can be inside the secure perimeter.
Wow.
of the debate. So I have to head up to the U tomorrow and get my brain tickled. I have not been tested yet, but I've basically been in my house for the last 7 months. So,
hey, well, they have the saliva test now. So maybe
I don't know what they're using. I don't know what they're using.
The other one.
Yeah, I'm really cringing, because I've talked to people who've had that test. And I'm like, if that right there is not the single biggest reason to socially distant and wear a mask, seeing what that thing is, you know, I don't know what's going to convince people. So do you think that this is going to end the presidential debates? Because the president and the first lady are quarantining for an undisclosed amount of time. You know, the next presidential debate isn't for another week or so, but you know, I wonder if that one's going to go forward, and I wonder if the other one is going to happen as well.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be interesting. Part of me kind of hopes the debates are over because that was just painful. But you know, I don't know. I'm always so hopeful that we'll get some good policy and some good discussions, and so I would be bummed if we had to miss out on that. But it'll be interesting to see.
Well, you just gave me a segue, so let's talk about the presidential debate that happened earlier this week. I think full disclosure, you were a Republican delegate for Trump in 2016. Were you also elected this year as well, even though you didn't get to go?
Well, actually, yeah. So I did get to go this year. I was one of the six that got to go.
Oh, you were one of the ones who went to Charlotte. Okay.
Yeah. So I was elected as a national delegate back in 2016, but I don't think anybody that went from our delegation was excited about Trump back then. It was crazy. You know, we were all kind of never Trumpers, the crew that ended up going back there. But yeah, this year I was one of the delegates that got to go to Charlotte. You know, I got to say that debate was just painful. I mean, from the get-go, when we had constant interruptions, I was just cringing, thinking, oh, come on, please, let's just have a normal debate. Let's just talk about good ideas and policy and accomplishments. And, you know, I just feel like, man, President Trump missed out big time because he really, if you look at his record, he really does have an impressive list of accomplishments, everything from, you know, the Middle East peace talks to some of the things he's done with deregulation and China. It's been pretty impressive, I think. Even though we hate his personality sometimes.
Yeah,
there was a lot to say and he didn't do it. I mean, he just kept interrupting and that became the distraction, and Biden didn't react well. I mean, there was such an opportunity for one of the candidates to really shine as far as being somebody that, you know, we want our kids to look to and say, hey, here's somebody who's just a stellar presidential candidate.
It's difficult. You know, I used to fall into the trap of who won debates, who lost debates. I don't think you win or lose debates anymore. But I do agree with some of the emerging consensus that came out of this is that Biden fared better because Trump sabotaged himself. Trump shot himself in the foot repeatedly. And if you look at his strategy, I truly believe that President Trump was trying to get Joe Biden to stutter. And I have a stutter. I have a speech impediment. I've struggled with it my entire life. And if I get thrown off by someone, you know, it's very hard to get back on track. And that's where the stutter comes out. And to me, that's what it seemed like the president was trying to get the vice president to do, because they have spent millions of dollars on that campaign with this assertion that the vice president is senile, and a video like that would be the video of him stuttering would go towards that narrative. So that's what it seemed like he was trying to do. I know that that's not what his advisors told him to do, but the president doesn't seem to listen to his advisors because he won last time when people told him he wasn't going to win. So I'm getting the sense, and knowing what little I know about Trump's personality, you can't tell him what to do because he won last time. So he's going to continue to try to do the same thing, and he thinks he's bulletproof. So I do think that the debate was slightly better for the vice president because Trump shot himself in the foot. And then coming out of it, I think that Biden was the quote unquote winner because he's up in the polls. He was winning going in, and I don't think anything changed that. So
yeah,
now's your chance to tell me where I'm wrong.
I have to just say, I don't think either of them were winners on this. I mean, you're right. I think Trump was trying to throw Biden off for sure. I don't think, I'm not one that believes he's trying to get him to stutter necessarily as much as just get him flustered to the point where he did what exactly he did, which is start calling names and get off message and that kind of thing. And so, you know, I agree, but that it's too bad because Biden really had an opportunity to shine because of that, because Trump's interruptions were so obnoxious to all of us watching. Biden really, and a few times you even saw him look at the camera and talk about the American people, which is awesome. Like, that's what we need, right? But he didn't keep that decorum and civility And that's what people are looking for. I mean, that's the anti-Trump, right? Is those who are looking for somebody who are going to bring back civility and everything else. Well, Biden didn't show that. And so, you know, one of the things that I will sometimes talk about is, you know, we've got two buses here in this election and we've got two bus drivers, and you've got a group of people who are saying, you know, I want where that bus is going. And that's how I'm going to choose who to vote for. It's which bus do I want to get on? Because where is it going to end up for our country? And then you've got people who say, man, whoever's driving that bus matters, because I'm going to have to sit on a 12-hour bus ride. And do I want the crass guy in the front who's making fun of people the whole time, who's going to be a terrible example for my kids and how he speaks about people, you know, or can I just put on my headphones and know that bus is going to get me somewhere? Mm-hmm. Or do I want the other bus where, you know, maybe the bus driver is a little bit nicer, you know, maybe hopefully he doesn't fall asleep while he's driving. And, you know, hopefully that's a more of a personality that my kids can look at and listen to. And that's why some people are gravitating to that bus, and they don't care so much where that bus goes. It's the bus driver. And in this debate, you didn't get that real civil leader. I don't know. It's just too bad, because Biden, I think, had an opportunity and he blew it.
I see what you're saying, but I think that argument presupposes that there's a large group of people who haven't made up their mind yet. And I think that group is smaller and smaller. You know, I've been reading a lot about the election of 1980. And going into that election, I mean, Carter was the incumbent, but I think America was just done listening to him. I think they were ready to move on and they were looking for some sort of alternative. So, you know, I think we might be at that point where America, the polls have shown that they've been in a firing mood over Trump. You know, that's and if you believe the polls, and I'm sure I'm going to be getting emails saying LOL polls. Anyway,
they worked out well 4 years ago, didn't they?
Well, you know what? Don't get me started on that, because the polls were right, but they were wrong in three key states and there was a polling error. But even if you look at if you look at today, I was reading something by Sam Wang from the Princeton Election Consortium, and he said, you know, Biden is farther ahead today than Hillary Clinton was. And if you had as big of a polling error as there was this year as there was in 2016, Biden still wins, right? So he's outside of that polling error. So there's going to have to be a massive polling error. But back to my original point, I don't think that there's that many persuadable voters out there. I think the electorate has pretty much made up their mind about Trump. And I think a majority of them are ready to fire him. And that's why you're seeing in the polls that Biden is ahead. That's why you're seeing in state polls that Biden is, he's at 50% or higher in a number of swing states. That's significant. But making your case to the undecided voters, which is what these debates are about, you know, I see what you're saying. And I think Biden's plan going in was to talk to the camera, talk to the American people. It was a difficult situation. I think that Trump really threw him off in the first half hour. Biden was really shaky in the first half hour, but I think he gained his footing. I just don't know how many people watched past that, because, man, I have not had a drink in almost 20 years, but man, I thought about starting up again after watching that, because it was bad.
Well, and there were some cringy moments too, where you know, anytime, and I've run for office, and so I understand this, but I feel like your kids your kids should be out of politics. Like your family should not have to endure the attacks that you do as a candidate. And mm-hmm. I'll be honest, I got very uncomfortable when we're talking about Biden's children. And I just think, you know, yeah, I think there's some questions to be had, but how you talk about that matters. Yeah. And people, I don't know, maybe I'm a softie because
being no, I think. I think that's a very good point. I think that's a very good point. You know, I heard one pundit say what we got in that debate was Twitter Trump. You know, it was Trump on Twitter just getting up there. And I've said this about a lot of people. You know, and it's mostly candidates for Congress and above. There are some people you just simply don't understand what they're saying unless you're steeped in Fox News and right wing media or extremely online 24 hours a day. I'm online all the time. You know, that's where I live because that's part of my job. So I understood a lot of things he was saying, but you know, I look at the stuff he was bringing up about Hunter Biden and Burisma and all that stuff. And I just wonder if these voters who haven't been paying attention are like, what the hell was he talking about? Because it just seemed to make no sense. I'd like to get your thoughts about the big take that came out of this debate, which was the controversy over the president not condemning white supremacists. As a Republican, as a supporter of the president, as someone who was a delegate for him, what is your take on how that all went down? I'm not asking, you know, and you can certainly have the opinion, because I do think that there's a lot of that was open to interpretation, the way that went down.
Yeah.
But I would like to get your take on that and what you think happened and whether the White House handled the fallout properly, because the emerging narrative is that the president did not condemn white supremacists. And you know this better than anyone, because you are in politics. In politics, perception is reality.
Yeah, well, he fumbled that, I think. I don't believe he supports white supremacy. I really don't. And he has said that. I mean, he's clarified his position on that in other places. It's just interesting because during the debate, I mean, I don't know if his adrenaline's going and you get flustered and how the question was asked, if it seemed like they were going to try and have it be a gotcha question. And so it put him on the defense. There were some missed opportunities. I mean, I even think when they were talking about the ACA at the very beginning and hitting Trump on that, I thought, wouldn't it be awesome if he totally just threw everybody for a loop and was like, are you kidding me? We've got to keep pre-existing conditions, you know, or something that just was enough that, I don't know, like there were some such missed opportunities, because I believe Trump is not this hardcore, I don't know the right words to use. I think that his policies really are pretty good in most areas, and he just doesn't communicate it always very well. And so that debate really was an opportunity to not be Twitter and to show the American people, no, here are the things I've done. Here are the things that I'm going to do. Here are my policies on this. And if he could have been more policy oriented, holy cow. I mean, it would have surprised everybody. And I think he could have, because I disagree with you. I don't think everybody is set. I think you've got each candidate has their base that's set. I think there's these people who kind of know who they're going to support, but depending on what's happening, that can change. I think there's still persuadables. And so that would have been a good opportunity.
You know, I'm going to give you the points on this discussion, because I agree with you 100% that it was lacking a good substantive policy discussion. That's what we expect from our leaders, and we didn't get that. And I don't think we're going to get it going forward, because I do think that at least the second presidential debate is going to be wiped out by this positive coronavirus test. Okay, so let's move a little bit closer to home. There was another debate this week, and it was between the gubernatorial candidates here in Utah, Spencer Cox and Democrat Chris Peterson. Again, I think in the issue of full disclosure, you have endorsed Spencer Cox. And you also went to school with his running mate, Deidre Henderson, which blows me away. That's just it just seems strange that,
have you seen the picture of us at the mall in eighth grade?
Please send it to me. Please, okay. Please send it to me.
My Facebook page, but I'll
please I'll send that to me. Yeah, I want to see that. So
we've got the big bangs and we don't have any makeup on.
What year?
You're like 13. Let's see. It would have been 87.
Oh, okay. That was right in my prime. Okay. Yeah. Speaking of someone who grew up in that area, this is a complete digression, but have you watched Cobra Kai on Netflix?
No, but I hear good things about it.
Oh, it is so 80s-tastic. It is 80s-tastic. If you grew up loving 80s movies like I did, the montages are spot on. It's 80s-tastic. It's montage-tastic. My wife, literally, she grew up a little bit later than that, but she likes watching me watch the show because I'm getting such a visceral thrill out of a lot of the things that they are doing that are designed to, appeal to middle-aged men like myself who grew up loving that genre. So Please send me that picture and I'll try to post it with the podcast. Okay, oh, so
I don't know if I want you posting it, Brian.
Okay, then I won't post
it. I'm just teasing. I don't care. It's already out there.
All right. So what did you think of that debate? It was largely cordial affair.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I mean, I always just think, please, Utah, we cannot be like DC. And, you know, we are so much better here than what's happening on the national level. But yeah, it was so refreshing to have two candidates, well-spoken, very smart and articulate, be able to talk about policy. And I think they both did a really good job. I think it was great to have this nice cordial debate. It's kind of too bad that didn't happen after the other one, so we could all calm down and be able to sleep a little bit better. But yeah, I mean, I thought they did a great job.
Lots of doom scrolling that evening. And so, you know, it was a good appetizer, but the main course that later that evening was not terrible. Good. Now, the one thing that emerged from that was sort of a disagreement about returning kids to schools, about going back into the schools. And Spencer Cox took a hard line on in-person learning, saying that online only classes are harming kids. And he's gotten some pushback from the Salt Lake City School District, which is the only district in the state which has not gone back to in-person learning. Do you think that's a fair or unfair criticism? To me, it seems like it is a fair discussion of the positions and the merits of the decision, which is refreshing after what we saw from Ohio on Tuesday night.
Yeah, no, I think it's totally fair. I mean, he of course has, and the governor's done this as well, deferred to local control and let people make their own decisions. But it doesn't mean he doesn't have an opinion on what he sees as best for kids. And I'll tell you, I started the first Salt Lake County Intergenerational Poverty Task Force, and I chair that currently. And he chairs the state's Intergenerational Poverty Task Force. And so I worked with him a little bit on this. Those kids who are in poverty are harmed by online only. I mean, I can tell you one of our elementary schools in Salt Lake County had 25% who logged on to their Chromebook in the spring. And, you know, these kids, they need all of the help that they can get as far as being able to have a good learning environment and people who can help follow through and things like that. And so, you know, you have, there's a reason the ACLU has threatened to sue school districts who have done online only. And it's because it puts these kids in poverty at a huge disadvantage. And we need just the opposite. And so, you know, I don't know if the rumor is true. Somebody told me that one of the Salt Lake City school district board members has said publicly that one reason she doesn't want in-person school is because she doesn't want Trump to win the election. And she thinks that for some reason has a political effect. I don't think that it's going to matter for Utah, but
in this state where it hasn't gone for a Democrat since
1994, I don't think it's going to be close, but
that's a weird if true, that is a really weird calculation.
And sad if we're putting politics above kids.
For sure. Yeah, I agree with that as well.
But, you know, you look at the number of people who have left Salt Lake City School District to go to other districts to enroll their kids because they know it's good for their kids to be there. I mean, I agree with Spencer Cox on this. It's devastating to not have them in school.
So I thought that the Democratic candidate, Chris Peterson, acquitted himself well, but it's not going to make any difference. I mean, given the past trajectory of the races, you know, and what's happened in the past, I think the last Democrat to go over 30% was John Huntsman in 2004. It was Scott Matheson. John Huntsman ran in 2004. Scott Matheson was a Democrat. I'm probably wrong, but I think that was probably the last time that a Democratic candidate for governor got over 30%. The last three elections, it hasn't happened at all.
Right.
And I just don't think that this changed the trajectory of the race one bit.
No, and you have Democrats and moderates who like Spencer Cox. I mean, I think Spencer, I can't remember where I read it, but Spencer, I think in the debate looked a little bit more moderate, but really he's a conservative at his core. But he's liked by both sides. I mean, he's a likable candidate. It's not like we've got some, you know, ultra right extreme candidate that's in this spot. And so, you know, I think he will easily sail to victory.
Well, he's hard to run against in a Republican state. I mean, right. that's the issue right there. He's really hard to run against. He hasn't done anything to disqualify himself from office. You know, he hasn't done anything to change the trajectory of the race. And if you're ahead by as far as I'm assuming he is, we've seen some polls that he's shown up by like 20 or 30 points. That's just too much ground to make up, you know. And Chris Peterson, he's a nice guy and he's got some great ideas, you know, and he's got a background that I think acquits himself well for this position. But, you know, it's just Utahns aren't buying what he's selling, you know, and that's just the state of politics here.
And it's great. I always love it when we see good candidates who are in the race who can have good policy discussions because it's better for our state. I mean, ideas, it's always good to have ideas on both sides of the aisle that we can implement as a state. And so, you know, Utahns have definitely been the winners and the benefactors of two good candidates in this governor's race.
Let's turn our attention a little bit to coronavirus. We had another 1,000 plus case day on Thursday after a bit of a drop. We are currently in a surge. You know, the audit, the long-awaited audit from your former running mate, State Auditor John Dougal, came out this week. A lot of people were hoping it would come out before the primary election, and then it came out. So it finally came out. It was hard on the state for not preparing for this sort of eventuality. It was hard on the governor's office for the way that they handled the spending. But, you know, again, I don't think there was anything that was really much of a bombshell there, other than the fact that the mystery hydroxychloroquine purchase, because somebody purchased, but they don't know who. As my wife put it, she calls it the immaculate hydroxychloroquine that just kind of showed up out of nowhere.
Yeah, you know, and audits aren't supposed to pat you on the back for all these great things. They're supposed to find the weaknesses. And so you're right. I mean, we've never had something like this before. And I think our state leaders, as much as, you know, there's been mistakes made, but I mean, considering where we are compared to other states, I mean, we're doing a pretty good job. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just a tough one. And how long it's been drawn out is really tough. And I know that's something that we were going to talk about too a little bit is the legislature and the governor's emergency order. Do you want me to? Sure.
Let's make a quick transition. I had a couple of stories this week that there's a sort of a brewing battle among the Republicans up on the Hill about ending the governor's emergency order. You know, we've been under a state of emergency for 7 months now. There was a petition that popped up over the weekend, where a number of conservative Republicans signed on saying that they would like to end the governor's state of emergency and block him from issuing another state of emergency. But after that, there's been a lot of confusion about whether they could actually do that. There was a contention, by Representative Kim Coleman, who told me she has a legal opinion in her possession saying that the legislature can approve a resolution without coming into special session, which doesn't make any sense. If she has that opinion, she wouldn't share it with me. And the legislative lawyer said there's no mechanism at all. So I don't know what they're trying to do there. But there's a lot of people riled up about the governor's state of emergency and the fact that we're still in this state of emergency. Now, here's the way that I've been approaching it. And I've said this to people. When I listen to two debates and that inevitable question comes out, what is the proper role of government? My eyes roll so hard. You can probably hear them all the way down in Cedar City. But I think this is the one time where it's good to have that debate. What is the proper role of government? Who's going to be in charge when you have a chronic state of emergency, because the state statute clearly was not written for this kind of eventuality where the governor has all this power to do this sort of thing. The legislature is not acting on it. The role of government is the legislature makes policy, and the governor, he hasn't made too much policy, but also under this emergency declaration, he hasn't suspended any statutes other than telehealth for state employees. He hasn't really done anything. So, I think that this is the time to have that discussion. As a Republican, as a conservative, do you think that it's time to start having this discussion about what the proper role of government is, especially when we're in this chronic pandemic? And you're also a policymaker because you're on the Salt Lake County Council. So I'm sure that you guys have been having talks about this as well.
Well, and I think what most people don't understand. So I think we've got some legislators who are frustrated because they don't have authority or power to be that legislative branch of government during an emergency. But others are getting pressure from, you know, their constituents that this emergency has to end. And they think somehow if you don't have the emergency declaration, somehow that magically means that all businesses are going to open and we don't have to wear masks anymore and it's going to just end. And that's not what happens. And what you do is you declare a state of emergency so that you can, A, have the executive branch make decisions without having that that darn legislative branch mire them down in a checks and balance system, which you need. I mean, if you have a short-term emergency, when we had the earthquake, you've got to be able to make quick decisions, nimble decisions. And so it makes sense to have an emergency declaration where the executive gets to make those decisions. The pandemic has gone on so long, and I have been frustrated as a legislative member of a legislative branch that we don't get to make decisions on the budget that's related to the pandemic. We don't get to make the policy decisions. That has all been done by the executive branch. And the only carrot we have to hold in front is whether we're going to extend that emergency declaration. And so the other thing that you have this emergency declaration for is so that you can get recoup funds from FEMA. And a lot of people don't understand that. And so if you don't carry forth a declaration, you may not be eligible for those FEMA reimbursement funds. And so that's something to consider. You know, it's a really, really good discussion to have. It's frustrating as a legislative body to feel like we don't have the checks and balances during this, and especially when it goes on this long. And so I applaud our state legislators for looking at this. I think we've got to look at it, but we also have to recognize, let's not have this be political. Just because an emergency declaration isn't there doesn't mean the emergency is over and everything goes back to normal. It just means that you don't have this unilateral body that's making all the decisions.
Right. And you pointed it out, ending this emergency for the state, it would not end most mask mandates. Those come from the local health departments. Businesses restrictions would probably still be in place. It would not restrict the governor from moving different areas of the state to different color-coded levels of risk. So it really wouldn't do much at all. I do agree with you that the frustration is that the legislature hasn't been able to get together to act on this. But I also understand the balance that legislative leaders are going through, because this was designed to be a part-time legislature.
Right.
45 days. We have the shortest legislative session in the country at 45 days. And they have been in special session. It reminds me of at the beginning of the financial crisis, when they were in special session almost the entire time because of the budget problems we had back in 2008 and 2009. And, you know, I talk with people up on the Hill, they say the staff is burned out. You know, they're trying to write policy, trying to write bills, trying to understand where things are. There's the federal funds. They don't know if they get rid of the state of emergency, do federal funds go away? You know, plus they have the January session to get ready for. And yeah. So, you know, and they're just not staffed up to handle this on a full-time basis, and they've almost morphed into a full-time body. So, you know, that's I understand the balance that they're having, you know, the balance that they're trying to weigh here. And the reality is they're not going to be able to really address this until they get into the general session, which starts in January.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see what ideas are put forth instead, because you do need to keep that nimbleness. And, you know, when people say, oh, we don't think, I've heard some people say, well, we don't think we're going to lose those FEMA funds if we aren't in an emergency, don't have an emergency declaration. You know, I'm kind of a cheapskate. Like I'm a fiscal conservative. And if FEMA is going to offer our state funds, holy smokes, don't even take the chance of not being able to have those available for us. So they better make darn sure that, you know, they can still get those funds if they're not in an emergency state. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Last thing I'd like to bring up this morning, it is interesting because I like to get a perspective. I am not a member of the LDS Church. My wife grew up LDS, and she doesn't go to church, but she basically holds all the other tenets of the religion together. But there was an article in The Atlantic by McKay Coppins, who is a great journalist. And actually, he's going to be coming on the pod with me next week to wrap up the vice presidential debate. So he'll be my guest here on Thursday. And I like him a lot. But he wrote an article this week, and he is really well sourced in Washington. And the headline was "Trump Secretly Mocks His Christian Supporters." And there was a couple of paragraphs at the very end, and McKay is a graduate of BYU. He's also a member of the LDS Church, but he says, I've been curious about the president's opinion of Mormonism ever since I interviewed him in 2014 at Mar-a-Lago. During our conversation, Trump began to strenuously argue that Mitt Romney's exotic faith had cost him the 2012 election. I think that there's part of that to there. When I interrupted to inform him that I'm also a Mormon, he quickly changed tack, extolling my church's many virtues. Anyway, one of his sources for this article is Michael Cohen. So take that with what you will.
No kidding.
But he says, when I shared this story with Cohen, he laughed. Trump, he said, frequently made fun of Romney's faith in private and was especially vicious when he learned about the religious undergarments worn by many Latter-day Saints. Oh, my God, Cohen said, how many times did he bring up Mitt Romney and the undergarments? And to me, I think that that's part of the reason why Utah is so they're not 100% behind Trump. You know, his approval ratings have hovered right around 50%, a little bit below. He's been in negative area. And I think it's just he just does not tack with a lot of the values that members of the LDS Church have. Now they like his policies. They like the fact that he's a Republican. You had a Republican Congress helping him out, tax cuts, conservative judges, all that other good stuff. But his personal style, I don't think this is going to make any difference going forward. But it's to me, it's a data point that helps me understand the political landscape here in the state, where members of the LDS Church, you know, they're just uncomfortable with him as a person. And I'd like to couple that with the article in Politico from about a week ago, where it says Mormons rejected Trump as blasphemous. Now he likely can't win without them. So,
yeah,
you know,
Got both presidential candidates with their Mormons for, I guess they're not calling it Mormons, but, you know, Biden and Trump both have their groups that are specific to different religious groups to try to gain support. So it's definitely a thing. You know, it goes back to my whole bus driver thing. Mm-hmm. If I'm on this guy's bus, first of all, am I surprised that has mocked other religions? No, he mocks everybody. Like this isn't a surprising characteristic of President Trump, right? So I don't know that it's anything really that anybody's surprised with, but it goes back to the whole bus thing. I mean, do you want to be able to just put on your headphones and not have to listen to that bus driver up in the front, but know that mm-hmm. he's going to get you where you want to be? Or do you want the nice guy who's going to be your bus driver and, you know, you put up with wherever the bus might go if it's not exactly where you want to go? And I think that's what a lot of people in Utah are grappling with, right? What's more important to you? Is it ultimate policy that's going to impact the nation? Or is it, I want to be able to have this guy that I can show my kids, this is a good moral leader. Well, moral, I don't know if we can say that about either candidate, but this is somebody that, you know, is at least nice to people most of the time. Yeah. And there's differences there. And, you know, and obviously I don't want to dismiss those who truly do like Biden's policies, because there are those groups too. But, you know, I think that's kind of what this boils down to, is some people the bombastic comments, they can't handle that. And I respect them for it. You know, I get it.
We have a bit of breaking news here before we get to my interview with Tim Miller. This just was tweeted out from Senator Mike Lee. He has tested positive for coronavirus. Oh. He says, yesterday morning, I was experiencing symptoms consistent with longtime allergies. Out of an abundance of caution, I sought medical advice and was tested for COVID-19. Unlike the test I took just a few days ago while visiting the White House, yesterday test came back positive. On advice of the Senate attending physician, I will remain isolated for the next 10 days. So,
bummer.
Yeah, so probably will. I don't know how much it's going to affect his participation in the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. But this is probably, at least he doesn't have an election to run, right? At least he's not running. Yeah. He doesn't have an election to run. It's unfortunate. So I want to send some best wishes out to Senator Mike Lee, who I'm still trying to get on the podcast. Jason Chaffetz came on the podcast. Why can't you?
Come on, Mike.
Senator Lee, would love to have you on the pod. Okay, Amy Winder Newton, stand by. We're going to come back and wrap up things with you in just a minute. But first, let's get to my interview with Tim Miller of Republican Voters Against Trump. He's also a writer at large for Rolling Stone and The Bulwark, the host of the Next Level podcast. He's also with Snapchat. We'll have that for you in just a moment. Joining me on the podcast is Tim Miller. He does a lot of stuff. If you're not familiar with him, he is the political director of Republican Voters Against Trump. He also writes for Rolling Stone and The Bulwark. He hosts the Not My Party podcast on Snapchat. It's not really a podcast, but it's a show on Snapchat. He also is a co-host of the Next Level podcast on The Bulwark. He also worked for John Huntsman's presidential campaign in 2012. He's a fellow Colorado boy. I don't know how he has time to do all this stuff. And I don't know how I was lucky enough to talk him to coming on. But Tim Miller, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You make me seem busier than I feel, Brian. I don't know. I guess I'm just a content machine. I don't know what
Look,
to tell
I've, you. You know what? A content machine, I think, is a great branding tool for you. And you should just you should make t-shirts for that. So I know I would buy one. Anyway, I appreciate you coming on. We're recording this the day after the first presidential debate. I'm just going to ask the easy question that's in everybody's mind. What the hell was that last night?
It's what people bought in 2016. You know, this is what they signed up for. It was unadulterated Donald Trump, his id. This is not, I hear a lot of the other commentators out here talking about how he had this strategy, which was to rattle Biden, or, you know, maybe they considered this or that. I don't think it was any of that. I think this was raw, childish, bullying, race baiting Donald Trump. I think that he feels aggrieved by 4 years of the way he feels like he's been treated by the media. I obviously don't share that sense, but he has lost from 2016. There was a little bit of a scampishness, right? And I never bought it. You know, his charm never really worked on me. But I felt like there was this sense of, you still had the same bullying and complaining and race baiting, but he also had like a little humor and a little charm. And I think that he's just been, that's been beaten out of him over the last 4 years. I felt like it was just kind of his raw energy, and that drove the whole thing. I think Joe Biden did his best. You could obviously see what his plan is. As somebody who said in a million debate preps, you could see what they told him. It was, you know, you let Trump go crazy, you talk to the American people, you look in the camera and talk about how you care about their family. And he tried to do that from time to time. But, you know, when he's yelling about how your son's a drug addict, it's hard. That makes it hard. And Chris Wallace tried to rein him in, but that you can't rein him in. And so it's, you know, it's as simple as that. It's Trump being Trump. There's no strategy behind it. You know, as far as he's concerned, the people bought it in 2016. So why should you do anything different?
You know, as I was watching it last night, the thing that struck me, and I said this on Twitter, is it wasn't so much a debate as it was a Facebook thread on my elderly father's Facebook page come to life is what it was. But, you know, I wonder if you think it made a difference at all, because, you know, I spoke with someone at Fox News earlier today. Okay. And everybody has retreated to their corner so much that people are going to take away from it what they were going to take away from it. You know, I watched it, and as someone who has watched many debates, and I appreciate the art form, I was mortified by what I saw. I was really saddened by what I saw. But there are other people who said, you know, it showed Trump as an apex predator in politics. So, you know, is it going to change anybody's opinion of what's going to happen? And is it going to make any sort of difference at all when we get to the vote?
I mean, well, for starters, the Fox apex predator stuff is just pure propaganda, and that's what they're doing right now. That's all they're, sure. That's all it is just propaganda for Donald Trump. Nobody, they don't even believe this crap, most of them. As far as impact in the race, look, I hate to speculate without seeing data. I mean, there's some polling data that has come out that indicates people thought that Biden won last night. You know, I like to sit, you know, sort of wait a week and kind of see what the responses are and what impact it is. It's hard to kind of predict what sinks in with people. A lot of times what's being discussed afterwards, like, for example, I think Trump's really lost the post debate day in a major way. Deservedly so, by, you know, giving the most despicable answer in presidential debate history in response to whether he would condemn white supremacists, and actually giving an attaboy to the Proud Boys instead, and now having to kind of backpedal on that or try to half-assly. He's lost that, and so maybe that has some impact. Here are the things, without looking at the data, that I worry about. I worry that there's a certain type of voter who looks at last night and just says a pox on both their houses. Like this was a total dumpster fire. And these are two old Facebook geriatrics arguing with each other and I'm out. I'm worried about young people who might vote for Biden. Thinking that, I think that obviously Trump, continues to rev up his working class white base. I think there are more votes out there than people realize there in that group. But he didn't win anybody over and he's losing. So, I think his only path at this point is to juice that base as much as possible and depress turnout, in minority communities and on the left, which is why you see him out there tweeting today about how Joe was mean to Bernie and all this sort of stuff. I mean, Trump is not subtle in his strategy. So, long story short, I think that it will have a very minor impact, probably increasing the undecideds a little bit. We got two more of these to go, and Biden will maintain basically the lead he has.
You wrote something a little over a week ago, following the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that has really been churning around in my head, because I thought it was such an interesting distillation of the political moment we're in. And you tried to get inside the head of a 21-year-old who was born in 1999. Twice in their lifetime, they've seen a president elected by winning the Electoral College, but not with the most votes. They saw the only president that they have seen win with a majority of votes being denied putting a Supreme Court justice on for reasons, I guess. And then this year, the people who blocked that president are rushing through a replacement for another Supreme Court justice. And you said something that really stuck with me, and it was, there's got to be a sense of a lack of fairness among this group. And you warned that if we don't find a way to get that fairness back into the system, then people are going to find a way to fix that fairness, probably in ways that we don't like. And this is the group who's coming into the political system, and they're looking at it, and it's all they see is this nihilistic pursuit of power. And it doesn't matter what rules are. It doesn't matter what norms are. I thought that was such an eloquent distillation of where we are right now. How did you get into that mind frame? And what do you hope the people take away from that? Besides the warning that the people who are coming into the system are going to make changes to it, and it may be ways that we don't like.
Yeah. Look, a lot of times in my writing, I'm trying to talk to my fellow Republican friends who I know don't like the president, and who I know don't think that he's a bad person, and who yet are have retreated to their corners, to your point, are so stuck inside a bubble of their friend group, and in my case, they're the people they work with, their careers are on the line here. But I think for voters, sometimes it's just the people they talk to on Facebook that like they can't see clearly. How people outside that bubble view what is happening right now at this president. And a lot of times I'm trying to hopefully pop that bubble a little bit for them, since I was one of them not that long ago, and provide a, kind of look into, what the impacts of what is sitting by and enabling this president's flouting of the law, his lying, the way he's degrading our discourse, like what impact that could have. And it just jumped out at me because I was trying to consider how to explain that. And I think that looking at our politics through the eyes of a 21-year-old helps, because a lot of times my peers, I grew up in the 90s, right? Like everything worked, right? When I was growing up. I mean, the debates in 96 and 2000 were about the lockbox. Like what should we do with all this money that we have, right? I there was no consequential debates. There was a rally around the flag around Bush. You had the 2000 election. I think that, if you do not, change that perspective and think to yourself, man, step back and think, okay, I've come up in this world where things worked and now we're going through this tough time. That's a different worldview than looking at it from somebody who says, they came up in this world where everything was effed up from the start. And the way they see it, things are very unfair. And on top of the things that you listed, it's not just the Electoral College, it's not just Merrick Garland, but they look at the fact that Joe Biden, to win this time, Nate Silver says he has to win by 5%. You know, they look at the Senate. You know, I pointed out a lot of these kids, think about where, you know, they live. They live in Salt Lake. They live in Denver, where I'm from. They live in San Francisco, you know, Chicago, Atlanta. They're moving to these big cities where all of the dynamism is in this country, and their vote doesn't count. Like, they look at the Senate and they're like, you know, you have more votes out of the Dakotas than I do in my state. You know, they look at the Electoral College and they're like, these candidates aren't campaigning here. They look at the fact that Donald Trump went on the back of help from Russia. No, they impeached him. Nobody cared. And then they hear the president of the United States last night saying that our democracy is rigged and you can't trust it. Why would these people trust democracy? Why would they? Like, what in their experience, you know, would make them feel like, you know, confident in our system? And so that's a very different worldview from somebody who grew up in the Cold War era, where the U.S. did the right things and where things worked, right? Right after the Cold War era. So I think that a lot of times people are blind to that. And so when I was writing that, I was trying to, you know, make people who are trying to jam through Amy Coney Barrett, who seems like a very fine person and who in any other circumstance I would wholeheartedly support for the Supreme Court, despite our disagreements on a couple of social issues, maybe have second thoughts about that. Should we really do this? We can, but should we? Like, what impact is this having on our body politic?
Well, and to that point, there's a terrifying scenario where the presidential election could come down to the House of Representatives and Liz Cheney in Wyoming, and you know, she would have as much power as the entire delegation in California to decide the next president. I look at that and I wonder if our country could. I think that would be the thing that finally breaks the back of this country. I just think that there would be no coming back from that. But again, I'm just, you know, a complete pessimist. You know, and I no longer expect the better angels of our nature to take hold.
This is the episode tomorrow of Not My Party on Snapchat. Download.
Well, there you go.
It looks at the nightmare scenarios. But I think that most of the Trump not leaving stuff is bluster and that he's a man baby. But there is, if this is a close election and there is a contested, if you look at the Pennsylvania naked ballot situation, if you haven't heard about this, there's this ruling where 100,000 votes could be not counted because they got mailed in one envelope instead of two. Like, that's preposterous, right? And Pennsylvania was decided by what, 20,000 votes last time, 30,000, far less than 100,000. So if there's a challenge in the tipping point state over something like this, over trying to discount ballots that were counted, and Joe Biden wins the popular vote by 5 or 6 million, but the Electoral College is contested on one of these things, and it goes to a vote in the House of Representatives, you know, I agree with you. That is a nightmare scenario. Hopefully our institutions will hold and we'll be able to solve it. But again, how can you then look with a straight face at the American people and say, this is not only constitutional, this is right in our democratic republic, but it's fair. And that's where I disagree. I know we're doing a Utah podcast here with Mitt Romney, who I've been with on most of the things he's done since he got in the Senate. He said in his statement about supporting, or I guess he didn't say supporting Amy Coney Barrett, but moving forward with it. You know, he said basically fairness. I don't have the quote in front of you. Fairness is just in the eyes of the beholder. But that's true. But the beholders are all of us. You know, and if the country starts to feel like this system, this democratic republic that we're in is not fair, you know, they'll blow it up. And I don't mean that in the sense of like there'll be bombs and Bill Ayers, but I mean that we will have a much more civil unrest than what we've seen, you know, in these pockets in Portland, and people will lose faith in the system altogether, and that will give even more credence to a future more credible, more competent strongman than Donald Trump. Like, we have to consider. We have to consider following the law, and we have to consider a sense of a democratic spirit and a fairness to this process. And I feel like all of my friends in DC, all my former, some former friends, I guess, have completely lost caring about that and this nihilistic pursuit for as much power as possible. And that has consequences.
You know, I think that nihilism is fine in small doses. Are you familiar with the Twitter account Nihilist Arby's? Are you familiar with that?
I've seen it. I don't know that I specialize in its oeuvre.
I just look at last night's tweet where they said, "Tonight, as two impossibly wealthy and senile old men argue on a global stage for absolutely no reason at all, remember, you personally will die alone and penniless, and no one will visit your grave, much less bring flowers. Please continue enjoying Arby's." And I think that's fine in small doses, but you know, if it's a whole political worldview. A couple of things before I let you go, and I really appreciate this, and I know you're very busy.
I'm good. Let's do it.
Because I have talked about all the things that you're producing. Let's talk a little bit about Republican Voters Against Trump. You're the political director for that group. And if you're not familiar with this, what I think you've done is really an interesting departure from groups like the Lincoln Project, where you're going out and finding Republicans who voted for Trump in 2016 and then letting them tell their stories. And some of them are incredibly compelling. It's compelling to watch people just sit down in front of a camera, perhaps at their computer and talk about it. And then you've gotten a couple of really big gets lately. I look at Olivia Troy, who was Vice President Pence's advisor for counterterrorism. Elizabeth Newman came out and told her story about why she cannot support this president. It started with Miles Taylor, who worked at the Department of Homeland Security. And the things that they've said have been absolutely chilling. And I think that if your goal is to change the hearts and minds of those squishy Republican voters who may be on the fence about voting, I think this is a very effective way to do that. Can you talk about how you came to this as an effective tool, or you saw this as an effective tool to do that, and then how you go out and find these people who tell you their stories?
Yeah. I mean, it started as a tool. I get no credit for this. Some of my colleagues, Sarah Longwell and some others, were doing extensive research on trying to figure out basically after 2016, what the heck happened? Like, what happened? Just like many people were feeling. And so did focus groups with people that voted for Trump, but said they disapproved of something about him. Maybe they didn't like the tweets. Maybe they didn't like his immigration policy. Maybe, you know, whatever it was. And ask them why they went for him anyway. What could persuade them? And you know, there's a lot of interesting learnings from this. But one of the major takeaways was, you know, they didn't like elites. They didn't like being lectured to from Washington. They didn't like, you know, people wagging their finger at them. And so when we thought about a strategy for how to convince these people to vote to pull the lever for the Democrat this time, you know, one that made sense and that bore out in testing was letting them hear from people like them. There are many people like this in Utah. I just really quick pulled it up. You know, Utah is like a prime state for this. We have over a dozen, it looks like, videos from people in Utah who are saying, "I'm conflicted." Right. I don't love everything about Joe Biden or the Democrats, but here are the reasons why I just can't vote for Donald Trump again. And you know, for some of them it happened right away, and for some of them it just happened over the coronavirus and the press conferences. And so, you know, we felt like that was the most compelling way to help convince people. We felt it might help give other people the courage to come forward. Some of these are so moving. You can see them at rvat.org. And then we've tested them, and we use the best ones, the ones that test the best in ads, as the short of it, and paid ads in the swing states. And then, you know, the thing we layered onto this was people that went to work for Trump. You know, we thought that was in the same vein. Like, they still are sort of elites in a sense. So it's a little bit different, but they have credibility because they're not like me, a guy with Trump derangement syndrome, right? Like, they went and gave Trump a chance. They went in, they wanted him to do well, they worked for him, and they saw him up close. And to a person, they're saying he's worse than you think. Like, he's terrible. He doesn't care. I mean, Olivia Troy's saying he doesn't care literally about people living or dying. He cares more about the fact that he doesn't want to shake hands with disgusting people. Elizabeth Newman, who is his director for threat prevention, saying that after El Paso, they tried to get him to talk about white nationalist violence and the threat here, and he wouldn't do it. He'd take it out of talking points. So, you know, those are, I think, also in the same vein, they're compelling messengers and hopefully can nudge other people who are similarly minded. And, you know, it's not all Trump voters. I know in Utah, there are a lot of Evan McMullen voters where this is another big category. The Biden can win this election just on the backs of people who last time said, I hate both of them. I'm going to vote for Evan McMullen or Gary Johnson. Not like libertarians for life or Green Party people for life, people who traditionally voted for one of the major parties, but last time just threw their hands up. Biden can win the election just by winning about half of them. Like, forget everybody else. Forget winning over Trumpers or winning, bringing over new people. So that's also a big part of the message and the voter that we're trying to reach.
I think it's really effective because they bring up points and they say things that you think about afterwards. It's not these quick hitter, funny ads that, you know, hey, I'm going to share this on Twitter and then it's gone. It's the kind of thing that sticks with you and kind of rolls around in your brain. So I have to applaud you because I think it is a very effective political tool, regardless of which side you're on. And also, I'm extremely jealous of you that you get to talk and geek out over focus group information with Sarah Longwell. I love listening to the Seek Secret podcast on the Bulwark. I'm a subscriber. I listen to that every time it comes out because she just talks. I so badly want to just geek out over focus group stuff because that stuff is fascinating because I'm a junkie. So
I'm sitting in on one in 90 minutes. So.
Oh, man. Okay, I'm just going to live vicariously for you is what I'm going to do. Last thing, let's talk about Not My Party on Snapchat. I'm 51. Snapchat completely baffles me. I don't get it. I don't know. I don't understand the appeal. My children are on her all the time. I did download it to watch your show, which I'm very impressed. Yours and Peter Hamby's Good Luck America, which I think is great. But the day I downloaded it, my son texted to my daughter and said, "Alert! This is not a drill. Dad has downloaded Snapchat." To me, it's interesting because you're presenting political information in a way that I think is entertaining and grabs the attention of our short attention span, the short attention span consumer on Snapchat. And so I applaud you for doing that. I saw Peter Hamby at a conference, and one of the things he said to reporters, and this stuck with me, is he said, "I need you guys need to start spending time in places that make you uncomfortable to talk with voters, to do sorts of things." And so this is a place that makes me uncomfortable, but I think that you're on to something. So I applaud you for that. Can you talk about the show and what inspired you to take this to Snapchat instead of like YouTube or something?
Yeah, thank you. I do want to talk about this, but you said it was the last question, but I have one thing I want to geek out with you about.
Sure.
So it's the second to last question. And then I'm getting into the questioner's chair. Here's the thing about Snapchat. Part of the reason, Peter's a friend of mine, and so, you know, I'd been talking to him and we had it in there. We wanted to come up with, we're looking for creative things at the Bulwark. Here's the reality. Our audience at the Bulwark is mostly people my age and older. Right. It's with a few exceptions, the types of people that engage in this kind of political commentary and engage in the Twitter conversation are largely people in their 30s and older. Right. And so a big part of the Bulwark's theme is we want to give a voice to people who feel homeless in our politics, who feel like, you know, they're worried that the Democratic Party is going too far left. Maybe Joe Biden seems fine, but man, most of the party seems a little out there for them. But then they look at the Republicans and they're like, this is disgusting. Like, I can't even believe that it's a cult. And so where am I? I like politics. I feel homeless. The Bulwark wants to be a home for those people and to write about politics in a way that they can relate to and engage with. But how do we talk to young people like that? And in this Snapchat show, the Not My Party Snapchat show, I just looked at the stats before I got on. It's about half of the viewers are under 21. 98% of the viewers are younger than me. I'm not going to say my age, but just that's all you need to know. 98% are younger than me. And it was, I don't have it off the top of my head, but like I think a quarter, 20% are 13 to 17. So, this is a different, they're engaging in news and politics differently. There's a lot of bad information that they're getting, particularly on YouTube. They're hearing mostly from, you know, kind of the AOC crowd and like the Charlie Kirk, you know, white grievance youth. And if this country goes down the path of the DSA versus the white grievance youth, you know, we start to look like Europe, you know, where you have a socialist party party and a nationalist party. That's not a good place to go. So we've got to start talking about, you know, other alternatives to young folks. So I'm passionate about that. Not my party is very cool in that regard. And my pushback to you, if we're going to nerd out, is I want to nerd out about Utah politics. I worked for John Huntsman, like you said, in 2012. Spencer Cox was, I think, one of the bright lights of the Republican Party for a long time, and I really kind of admired his Twitter persona, despite being a jazz fan for a long time. I don't know Spencer. I obviously know former Governor Huntsman well, and it was tough for me as an outsider to follow that primary with all the other stuff I'm doing. What was the driving force of that? How did two guys who are quite moderate end up being, you know, basically for Trump? How did they navigate that? You know, give me some local Utah gossip and buzz on the Cox Huntsman break.
Well, as you know, it was extremely close, decided by less than 7,000 votes. And that's because it was a four-way primary, which is something we really hadn't had in a race that consequential before. You know, we had Greg Hughes, who was a former Speaker of the House, and he overtly courted the Trump vote and was attacking Spencer Cox for not being Trumpy enough. And you know, this state is not a Trumpy state, but the Republicans are, and the Republicans who come out to vote are. One of the things that I know John Huntsman did is he tried to encourage independent voters, unaffiliated voters, who normally vote for the Republicans in the general election, to register as a Republican because we have a closed primary process. So he was trying to get them to come over. And then there was also a not very effective move by the Democrats to also game the primary. But I think that also made it very, very close. But if it had been a two-way primary just between Huntsman and Cox, I think Huntsman would have won that. And a lot of people I talk to believe that as well. But Greg Hughes and Thomas Wright, the businessman, that they siphoned off enough of the votes that it made it as close as it was. And one of the things that Cox did, and you'll like this because you're a data guy. I'm fascinated by where campaigns spend their advertising dollars. And Cox spent, I think, well over half of his entire advertising budget online, on Twitter ads, on YouTube. He spent a lot of money there, and we hadn't seen that before. And it was very effective for him. He came out of the gate first. He was running for over a year. He was in the race for a lot longer than everybody else. But I do think his game on social media and on Twitter was really, really good, and that gave him a leg up. So he spent a lot of money there, and it ended up winning for him. So at least that's my view of it.
That's cool. That's interesting. And I'm glad, despite the fact that, you know, I guess you got to do what you got to do these days in the party. I wish you would have been a little stronger on the Trump side of things. He has just been steadfast on the issue of refugees and immigrants and being welcoming, and the fact that this is a country that is welcoming and that it's the Christian thing to do. And I was extremely impressed by Cox on that matter. And it's something that I'm passionate about, and I'm happy that there will at least be, presuming he wins in November, a couple of Republicans left who are not nativists. In that sense, Utah is a little bit of a bright light. So that's good.
So on Snapchat, it's called Not My Party. Yep. Download Snapchat and subscribe to it. You swipe left, right? Is that what it is? You swipe left and then you search for Not My Party?
Correct.
Okay, so I did get that correctly. The Bulwark, they have a program called the Bulwark Plus. It's $10 a month. It's worth it. They have some great newsletters. You write one on Sunday that I always look forward to. And then Charlie Sykes, who I think is fantastic. My wife, who's not conservative, she loves his show. I turned her on to that. Great. So she's all over that, and she likes Mona Charon's show as well. So it's a great pub publication. $10 a month. I don't think that's too much for people to spend. So subscribe to that.
And if you're a college kid, we'll give it to you for free. My Twitter, my DMs are open. Just DM me.
Well, there you go. And his Twitter will be in the show notes. So Tim Miller, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Brian. Go Nuggets.
All right, we're back with Salt Lake County Councilperson Amy Winder Newton, who's helping me with the weekly wrap-up. And as we finish up here, Amy, tell me something I don't know.
Well, Brian, I got to tell you, after 16 years of having a Democrat mayor of Salt Lake County, we are going to have a Republican mayor come November or come January. There you go. That's something you may not
know. What makes you say that about Trent Staggs? You're talking about Trent Staggs, who is the Republican nominee against Democrat Jenny Wilson. Why are you saying that?
You know, it's an interesting thing. We have not had this strong of a Republican candidate for county mayor ever. I don't think. I think he's the strongest candidate we've ever had. And you know, just what I've seen, him out working, I think people are, there's some things that they're not happy with, tax increases and some of the lack of law and order and lack of support for law enforcement. There's just some different things there that I think are making the dynamic this year just different enough that it gives Trent a really, really good shot. I mean, Jenny's got great name ID, and I work with Jenny. I think she's great. You know, we work well together, but I'm just seeing some things and some momentum with the Staggs campaign that I just don't think can be overcome.
Well, you've just given me an idea for a story. I guess I'll have to dig into some county level data about how Jenny Wilson did in her 2018 Senate run against Mitt Romney, because that'll probably give us an idea of some areas where there are strengths for her and some areas that might be a problem. That would be interesting, because the last Republican to hold that office was Nancy Workman, who just passed away earlier this year. And I do remember that race because it was absolutely chaotic, because there were charges of corruption and she didn't want to get out of the race. And basically, it was a race where she lost it more than Peter Caroon won. Because you
nobody
had
nobody knew Peter. It was an interesting thing, because
and I think that Clark Ivory was a Clark Ivory who ran the write-in campaign that year. Because she finally decided to step aside from the ballot, and then she was exonerated later on. So I mean, that was just a whole thing. That was a crazy race, but
for sure.
I think it, yeah. So anyway, all right. Let's talk about what stories are coming up next week. And obviously, it's going to be the vice presidential debate here in Salt Lake City on Wednesday night. That'll be an interesting thing. Hopefully, it will be much more genteel and policy oriented than what we saw last.
Oh, week. I hope so. I'm sure it will. I mean, I think you're going to have candidates who really are going to be focused on policy. So I think it's going to be a good debate. That's going to be interesting. I think the Supreme Court nomination hearings, as we
does that start
with Amy Coney Barrett. Week? I am not sure when they start officially.
I think it starts the week after. Lindsey Graham said it was the 12th is when he started, but we'll still be getting a lot of that coming forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously something interesting to watch. Who else gets coronavirus? I mean, that's going to be interesting as we look at, you know, some of these high profile leaders who have been diagnosed, and now is there fallout from those. So that will be kind of interesting to watch as well.
Mm-hmm. And just back to the vice presidential debate, you know, I've seen so many people online saying, well, you know, Kamala Harris is the person who made Brett Kavanaugh cry. So I don't think that Mike Pence is going to have a chance. I would caution people about that. First of all, I don't think the vice presidential debate is going to really change the direction of the race at all. It's not going to do anything. But I would caution people, because if you go, I went back and watched the 2016 debate between Pence and Tim Kaine during that presidential thing. And Pence's really calm demeanor made Tim Kaine look a little manic. So, I would caution against that, because people forget that Mike Pence was a radio host. He knows how to handle himself in these public situations, you know. So don't get your hopes up that Kamala Harris is going to just steamroll him, because I don't think that that's going to be the case at all.
No, I think it's going to be fun to watch, though.
It will be fun to watch, and I'm going to be excited that I get to be there. Just cross another thing.
If your test comes back negative.
If my test comes back negative, we'll go from there. All right, that's it. Amy Windwinder Newton, thank you so much for your time. Also want to say thank you to Tim Miller. Thanks for coming on the pod.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
All right, and remember, leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or share this on social media. Coming up next week, I'll have a conversation with McKay Coppins to wrap up the vice presidential debate. We'll also wrap up the week's news on Friday. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Brian Schott.